We interrupt our program to bring you this important message.
On August the 17th, 1988, 35 years ago, a Hercules C-130 fell out of the sky, and that typically doesn't happen. I was a young special agent. I'd been on the job just 3 years when I was dispatched by the National Security Council to go and investigate this plane crash. This was just not any plane crash. This plane carried the president of Pakistan, our United States ambassador, a two-star U.S. Army brigadier general, and what is the equivalent of the entire Pakistani chief of staff. And the backdrop for this plane falling out of the sky was during the height of the Cold War, with the largest covert operation underway in Afghanistan since Vietnam. And President Zia, who was on that plane, was our point man with support of the Afghan Mujahideen. And all of a sudden, our point man in Afghanistan for this highly sensitive operation falls out of the sky in this plane crash.
And now you were lead on this, correct?
I was. At the time the deputy chief of the counterterrorism division for the State Department as a special agent with the Diplomatic Security Service. And myself and another agent from my unit was asked to go out and coordinate the investigation to figure out predominantly how our United States ambassador was killed. And as a result of that, our assistance was offered to the Pakistani government. And it was really somewhat from a historical perspective, a chaotic mess, as you can imagine, just because of the geopolitics of the region during that time period. So, you know, I've written about this in the past. I've talked about it a fair amount of time over the years, but, you know, I can look back on it now and like so many of us in law enforcement, whether you're at the local, state or federal level at times, you very quickly get in over your head. And I can clearly say I was probably ill-prepared for the magnitude of this kind of case, and certainly not one that had spent a lifetime investigating plane crashes by any stretch of the imagination.
Yeah, we have that time where when we get assigned something or we're thrust into something and we're point or lead on it, I think all of us always feel that way, like a little bit overwhelmed and think, well, it's me. I'm the one that's got to do this and lead this. But then it's almost like we kind of like a quarterback relaxes in the pocket, the pressure's on, and then you just go to work. And it sounds like that's what you did. You just went to work and focused on the investigation.
Well, I can say this with a high degree of candor, BC and Ski. I can vividly recall standing there, you know, within hours of this plane crash. I was flown over on a special air mission by the U.S. Air Force. We take this god-awful trip through the Punjab of Pakistan with the Pakistani intelligence service escorting us, the Pakistani military. And I can remember getting there and standing there and looking at this smoking hole in the ground. And it was the first time in my career after I transitioned from being a police officer to this job that I really regretted leaving the police department, because I kept thinking, what in the world am I doing here? I don't really know what I'm doing, but you know, I have to figure it out like we have to do in this job. And I was smart enough to know the stakes at play. The one thing that I didn't know at the time, just, and this was before the days of the internet really taking over and social media, the fact that we had this covert effort underway in Afghanistan arming the Mujahideen, and the man that perished on this aircraft was the point person for this, was something that was very closely held in Washington at the time. And even though I had been in the counterterrorism division now for a good 3 years, I did not know that. You know, we had indications that something was going on, but I literally had no need to know that to do my job, per se, just how Washington works, how it all works in this kind of business. And so it was, that really hit me, you know, hard, you know, thinking about that, because then you have to look at a whole range of other suspects and try to very quickly rule out, you know, mechanical, catastrophic, electrical, pilot error, and you know, sabotage of the fuel tanks, and all the different laundry lists that you would run through. So I have to say that, and out of all the cases I worked through my career as a counterterrorism agent, that was probably the most complex of any of them.
And you said you have written about that, or no?
I did. I wrote about this at some length in my memoir, Ghost, Confessions of a Counterterrorism Agent, that Random House published. And so for anybody that's interested in the history of Afghanistan, or how we got there, what led to us being involved there, the Soviet withdrawal of Afghanistan. I mean, I was reading the paper today, and it seems like the same things we were dealing with in the 80s are back in front of us today, whether that be Russia, China, Iran, you know, it's the usual suspects that are still here. It's very much Shakespearean with, you know, the past is prologue, right?
Mm-hmm. BC, I have so many questions, but you need to go ahead and introduce this man.
Yes. Yes. So this is who I've been telling you about when I reference the book Root Rules. And when I post it about, man, every few months, I'll post in my story on Instagram and on our account for the Disruptors. But I read this book, Beirut Rules, maybe now about a year and a half ago, and got to jump on a podcast with Jason Piccolo, who has the Protectors podcast, and he had Fred Burton on, the voice you hear now, and I was blown away by the book, and I can remember taking notes, you know, and I do that when I read anyway, but what Fred's done in this book is outline Lebanon, the rise of Hezbollah, and some of the early years of what kind of, I guess, is deemed as that early era of terrorism, but also was a cop, you know, before that life of joining the State Department. So when you hear me talk about Fred a lot of times, this is who we're talking about. And I'll tell some stories from the book and that sort of thing, and also reference it. And, you know, I'm getting ready to turn it back over to Fred. But when I'm talking about reading books on terrorism and people say, well, I've read this, I've read that, I always recommend this one. I want to say Jack Carr had recommended it for quite a while. And he's always got a really solid book list. And so it's the same thing. And you start to see posts like that. And like Fred had mentioned, some of the other books that he's written, and we'll talk about some of the other assignments that he's worked. But yeah, to go from a patrol officer to what he just talked about. So imagine working lead on an international case like that.
Yeah. So when you're boots on the ground, standing in front of that smoking hole, having those doubts of what you signed up for, at what point did you get briefed that the point man for this gigantic covert operation is on that plane?
It's a great question, Ski. I certainly did not know that during the first probably 72 hours, if not the first 4 or 5 days I was in the field at the crash site. If memory serves me right, we had a brief stopover at the U.S. Embassy in Islamabad, Pakistan. And as fate would have it in this business, as we all know in law enforcement, our actual senior agent in charge of the embassy at the time was slated to be on that flight. And the U.S. ambassador wanted to go instead. So he was bumped off the flight and was still, you know, very much shaken up as to what had taken place. And I remember a conversation with him in the hallway at the embassy that, you know, hey, there's been a lot going on with Zia and the president of Pakistan and our intelligence liaison and so forth. So we'll talk more when you get back from the field kind of story. So it didn't really start to unravel for me, Ski, until many, many weeks later in the course of the investigation. I got back to Washington. I went back and did some briefings at, you know, for leadership and so forth. And the pieces of the puzzle started to kind of connect. And, you know, when Zia went down on that crash, other major news outlets started to probe more and start connecting the dots. So it started kind of trickling out in the open source during that time period.
Yeah, that's that. I was always fascinated just working different levels and with different agencies and state, local, federal on just, you know, you could have 5-6 guys on an operation and there's always one or two guys that know a little more than you. And I always just thought it was interesting how you could be working shoulder to shoulder and there's still stuff that people cannot tell you because they're sworn or they've signed something, or it's just, that's fascinating.
You know, it, it's funny, you know, you were kind enough to mention Beirut rules and, you know, one of the other major cases that I had was the kidnapping of the CIA station chief in Lebanon, Bill Buckley, which you can only imagine today in our social media world if the head of American intelligence is kidnapped and missing and he can't be found. And I remember at times thinking there has to be somebody else that knows what's going on but me here, right? And lo and behold, to your point, Ski, we had this Iran-Contra mess unfolding behind the scenes, which myself and those of us assigned to the hostage location task force were completely out of the loop. And we had no idea what was going on with Iran-Contra, you know, trading the missiles to Iran in exchange for hostages. Yet our job was to find the hostages, debrief the hostages, and so forth. But, you know, you all know what I'm talking about in this kind of work. At times, you don't really know what to say or think, but, and you always want to believe that there's somebody else that really has the whole picture. And at times I've found that that has been the case. And at other times, kind of the light bulb went off in my head that, you know, nobody knows what the hell's going on here. So It's my job to kind of figure it out. And that's the kind of scary things about, you know, that world. And, you know, it was a totally different era too, you know, before 9/11. Literally, terrorism wasn't a national priority. And I've had this conversation with my good friend Jack Carr and Brad Thor, another very good friend of mine, a thriller writer. He has on one of his missions with in his book, Spy Master, he has his operators reading Beirut rules going out for this mission. And, you know, so the power of books and, you know, I feel very blessed at times to, you know, I was reading one of Tom Clancy's books recently, and lo and behold, they have me in the book helping Jack Ryan Jr., you know, save the world. And I can remember, you know, as a young agent, flying around the world on a TWA or a Pan Am Clipper class, with Tom Clancy books in my bag just to stay awake. And so, I'm not so sure how I got here.
Right. I think it's probably hard work and probably the number one thing that I say to Ski and a lot of other people about you is how you're ego free, you're humble, you know, and that's what I like about your message. And when you're talking to people, you've done incredible things and obviously influenced some other incredible people, but you don't talk as if or like other people we have met who have done extraordinary things, but they will pound their chest and they will tell us, you know, oh, I'm this bad dude, I'm this great. And, you know, we get turned off by that. Everybody wants to learn something, and everybody wants to know that we're kind of in the company of people who are very capable and very good at what they do. So I always like that about you, is that you don't brag or you don't come across like that when you're talking. And it's funny when you're mentioning that about Tom Clancy and Brad Thor. Like, again, that cycle continues. So somebody's reading Brad Thor's book, who is probably maybe a young, motivated, you know, American or any other country, because I'm sure the book's been translated many times, and reading that and then understanding that this is where it starts. Research, read your books, know what's going on overseas, know what's going on, you know, in that realm, and be, you know, just be knowledgeable instead of just sitting back and thinking maybe kicking a door in is always the best thing. Some people have to dismantle the entire organization, so to speak, or be lead of international investigation like you were.
Well, thank you for that. You're very kind to say that. I remember talking to a wonderful former retired, now deceased FBI agent by the name of Stan Ornstein. And Stan was extraordinarily helpful to me in helping piece together a cold case of mine that actually started in the jurisdiction where I grew up in. And I worked on the case as an agent, as a cold case. And I hunted down Stan. And the case involves the murder of an Israeli diplomat in my neighborhood. And it turned out that he was a hero of the state of Israel. He was an intelligence officer. There were allegations, pretty good ones, that he was Israeli intelligence service, Mossad, or at least wore a dual hat. And he was murdered, pulled in his driveway at night. Gunman steps out of the trees, 1973, fires five shots into him. You know, his wife runs into the house. Daughters come out and watch their dad die. And of course, because he's a diplomat, you have homicide division of the Montgomery County Police respond. You had the resident agent, Stan Ornstein, respond from the FBI. And I remember Stan telling me, to your point, BC, I said, Stan, what did you do when you got there? And he said, man, I was with the FBI. Look, we didn't investigate homicides in those days. Murder wasn't what we did, right? Mm-hmm. And he goes, I remember pulling up, not knowing what to do, trying to think of what they taught me at Quantico. So I pulled out my Polaroid camera and I just started taking pictures to kind of collect my thoughts. I pulled out a crime scene tape. Remember the old accident investigation tapes?
Mm-hmm.
And I just started measuring random things while I tried to remember how to process a crime scene. And here I was from the FBI, and the locals were expecting me to have all the secrets, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I think that, and we've come a long way. I mean, today, if something like that occurred anywhere in our great nation, you know, you would have, you know, evidence response team from the FBI. You'd have, you know, more oversight than you can imagine. You'd have more agents than you need to investigate that kind of crime. But it just wasn't like that back in the day. And that was kind of the way we did cases. I mean, and I felt a lot like Stan. Hell, I remember going over on a rocket attack on our embassy in Madrid, Spain. And I believe it was 1987. They kind of all run together in my mind, mm-hmm. but I think it was 87. And I had the same equipment. I had a measuring tape. I had a Polaroid. And I was kind of like a global detective. There wasn't a lot of mystery or science to what we did at times. We did the same thing that any cop would do that I had done on burglary reports, right? I just went out and started measuring things, figured out where the rocket was launched from, worked with the Spanish National Police, got access to the evidence, took pictures of the device, took some explosive samples home, and we ran it over to the ATF lab, you know, for some rapid analysis. So that's just how we did things for many, many years.
When you look at the murder of the Israeli gentleman you were talking about, and then you look at the method in which he was murdered, and at that time and in that neighborhood or in that jurisdiction, could that blend into any other murders, or would it look like it's an assassination? Like, you know, if you figure out how the crime was committed and then the motive of why, that usually leads directly to who or whom, or at least, you know, narrows down your suspect pool. Do you know if that was like one of those things right off the bat, the way the surrounding area, you didn't have any other kind of killings like that or typical for that type of neighborhood, right?
No, not typical for that kind of neighborhood, but clearly had all the modus operandi of a radical Palestinian group targeting a high-profile Israeli target on U.S. soil. And then as you draw back and look at the tempo of attacks globally with a similar MO, you could see that this very much fit within that pattern, that in 1973, poor Stan Ornstein from the FBI did not have visibility into that because the global collection database that was being done by the CIA in that window of time was pretty good, but there was not a lot of sharing of information across agencies like that exists today. So Stan was totally unaware of many other attacks that I had connected the dots to many, many years later that fit that typical kind of MO. So it took me 37 years to solve that case. I'm a little bit slow, but I did figure it out. And, you know, it was the Black September organization that assassinated Colonel Alon, and it was a political assassination on U.S. soil.
You know what's crazy is I'm just thinking about kind of where we started the conversation on need to know stuff. And we have a lot of listeners that have never been in law enforcement, and, you know, even young law enforcement officers, right? They want to know everything, and the people on the outside, man, I wish I got to know all this stuff. And it's funny how you hit a certain point where you just don't want to know things anymore because you can't unknow it, right? You lay down on the pillow at night before you close your eyes, and all that stuff's still in your brain. But it's really cool how when you do know things, like the assassination you're talking about right now, his neighbors had no idea what he was up to. They had no idea. And like, it's like, yeah, I've known this guy for 10 years. He's lived here. And it's like, oh, he was what? You know, and kind of like BC and I, just our in-depth knowledge of some of the gangs we were working and all that. And you wouldn't expect us to know that. And it's like, these covert roles where you have all this information and how you kind of have to keep it close to your chest. And, you know, the whole world sees it one way, but we see everything another way because we know so much more in that realm. It's just fascinating to me.
It's almost like I was teaching a course on terrorism not too long ago, and there's like a parallel universe that goes on.
Mm-hmm.
Within law enforcement and in the intelligence community and wheels within wheels. And it's, you peel the onion back a little bit and you see a little more. And at times it's kind of like the old man in, you know, behind the curtain in the Wizard of Oz, you're saying, oh my gosh, that's what that is that's causing all this ruckus or whatever. But, you know, you're absolutely right. I was telling someone the other day that it would probably have been much better for my mental health if I had just gone into fire and rescue, right?
I've said that before.
You know, you get to sleep a lot, you eat well, you get to work out, and everybody loves you. You know, it's not like really law enforcement.
No. Right. Well, the interesting thing now is, a lot of, and I'll say younger people, but also just, I should say, newer people to the police departments and who are getting into law enforcement, because there is a trend of people retiring from other jobs and then joining departments because they've always wanted to be a cop. They take a job elsewhere and they didn't, you know, maybe they didn't follow their interest at a younger age or whatever. And then they join a department and, you know, they crush it, absolutely crush it. But this whole idea that now, and I know the attacks are up on police officers and ambushes and a lot of just general, what we would just call hate, you know, just people hating on police officers. But when people have been in uniform, they know that's kind of what we expect that behavior. You know, we expect people, sadly, to hate us a lot of times. So it's interesting now that people are expressing a lot more about this idea of disrespect towards people in uniform. But I mean, anybody that works a beat with any kind of drug activity or gangs or you know, open air drug markets, you're going to get that. So it's just one of those things. Now, one of the parallels that Ski and I've talked about, and you mentioned kind of earlier when we were talking about our backgrounds and stuff, but the idea now that so many agencies, local, federal, and intelligence gathering agencies are now being able to talk a lot more and a lot more frequently than ever before. So if an incident happened, like a political assassination in a neighborhood, that now, kind of like we mentioned, it would be moving at light speed. The ability to be able to pick up a phone or sometimes walk down a hall and say, I need to go talk to so-and-so who's with a joint terrorism force, because this may be looking a little more political or leaning a little more on the terrorist side type of thing. And to me now, it's absolutely incredible, the assets too, and the things that we're able to develop and learn. And I know that working informants and sources of information, be it a citizen in a neighborhood or an actual gang member, when we flip them into informants, I would imagine it's very similar to what goes on overseas or in a terrorist organization. Like I think you've talked about it in the past, but that ability to get information directly from another human being. Yeah.
Oh yeah, clearly. I mean, you could do a PhD thesis on this. You know, it's been my experience that every successful attack that I've ever investigated, whether it be a political assassination or a bombing, you know, boil down to two variables. The first is a lack of human intelligence to prevent that from occurring. You know, once a Timothy McVeigh gets in his Ryder truck and starts heading towards the federal building, it's too late. And then the second variable is a failure of tactical analysis. You know, you've collected that signal, but you can't make sense of that signal due to all the noise. And that's been my experience in doing a lot of these after action investigations of major bombings, major embassy attacks, you know, assassinations around the globe. And but you hit on a very factual point from where I sit. I mean, I've gotten way more credit than I deserve for the capture of Ramzi Yousef, you know, the mastermind of the first World Trade Center bombing. In Pakistan, again, for a while there, for me, all roads led to Pakistan, which is probably one of the reasons why I can't go back to Pakistan, but that's a whole other story. But, you know, we got lucky with a human informant that came forward and said that he knew where Ramzi Yousef was, and I didn't believe him, like, you know. We all know informants lie, right? And lo and behold, he was providing some good information and said that Yousef was in this, you know, flea bag hotel and brought us some of his explosives that matched. And so we were able to capture Ramzi Yousef. We were able to get the informant, you know, out of the country. And then we were able to pay that informant $1.2 million in cash.
Wow.
You know, using our Rewards for Justice program reward monies. That was another one of the programs that was in my office that I ran for many, many years. When we first started that program, we had $2 million kind of kitty that then went up to $5 million. And then after I left, it went up to $20 million, you know, to capture mm-hmm. Bin Laden. But, you know, from a counterterrorism perspective, for those of you who may listen to this podcast, probably one of the most successful programs on the war on terror, whatever we're calling it today, has been that Rewards for Justice program, because that's a perfect example of paying an informant to capture an FBI top 10 fugitive. And we paid many, many others to stop attacks. You know, in fact, the entire program was designed primarily to stop attacks from occurring, not so much fugitive apprehension.
Yeah, I want to jump on that and say, for those listening, that's also the secret to disrupting violence in your cities.
100%.
If police departments focus on developing actionable intelligence, and mostly directly towards their gangs, or if there's a drug nexus, a drug network, but if you focus on your gangs in your city and do just like Fred's mentioning about paying sources, but the main thing is, can I get information from them that either is going to capture a fugitive who's already committed violence, or can I get information on a future act or something within the within the gang that's going to lead to the disruption of that future violence? And the main thing you said that Ski and I kind of laughed about when you said you didn't believe him because a lot of informants lie, of course, because there's money on the table and they're putting their life on the line. They want that money. However, you verified, or you know, your unit, you and your unit verified what he said through the sample of the explosives, through the information he was giving that could be verified. And then, in fact, when he's captured, he's telling the truth. A lot of officers and deputies and agents, when we're teaching, the feedback will be, well, I don't trust informants because last week they're a gang member. Well, they're still a gang member. They're still committing crimes, potentially, depends on what their motive is for cooperating. But also, is there information, something that you can verify, and is it actionable? And if it is, act on it. And I mean, I won't go into all the examples, but we've been doing this for years and actually disrupted a lot of violence. And like you said, we've actually prevented violence from occurring that no one's ever going to hear about. So it won't be in our statistics because it never happened. But we can verify it because we hear other sources talking about it, and then people getting upset because they couldn't get into a certain neighborhood to get access to an apartment where they were going to shoot it because they had in place, you know, to basically be visible because of actionable intelligence from a source. So it's one of those things that when people are, and I say this often, when people are reading books like Beirut Rules and other books that you've written, to, if they're in law enforcement, to see if some of that is applicable to their situation, the idea, the strategies, because it directly is, and it's developing sources and it's getting right to the root of it. So that's, I didn't know about a lot of some of your background in that situation, but I knew that sources were very, very important to you, and, you know, echoing that.
Yeah, I can't speak enough about that. You know, one of my, you know, primary motivations for writing Beirut Rules was, you know, I'll be blunt, guilt. You know, I still feel horrible that we were not able to get the CIA station chief out of captivity when he was abducted, and that he ended up being tortured and died a miserable death. And you know, this was a man who, you know, fought in the Korean War and was a Silver Star recipient, and fought in Vietnam and received another Silver Star, and volunteers to go to Beirut after the first embassy bombing to stand up America's eyes and ears and intelligence. And then lo and behold, he gets kidnapped himself. Mm. And at that time, I'm assigned to the CIA hostage location task force. And to close the loop about informants, the reason we could not find Bill Buckley was we lacked human informants in order to give us any kind of actionable intelligence as to where he was on any given time. And the tragedy in this is that the reason we lacked those informants was in 1983, when Hezbollah drove a truck bomb through the embassy, wiping out the CIA. It took out our eyes and ears of Lebanon. So the man who volunteers to go in to rebuild that network ends up getting kidnapped himself. And we're back in Washington with no human informants to help us find this man. Mm. So the vast resources of the U.S. intelligence community failed this man miserably. And, you know, that's something that in putting that story together, I wanted to make sure that people knew that not only was this a man who had served his nation in a gallant way with valor and heroism, and in many ways, his own government let him down.
Yeah, and I want to chime in on that just because we were talking about technological advances from when you were doing this to now. Everybody's pushing AI. It'll never replace human intelligence. As much as people like it and they want this new fancy, you know, technology that's out there, AI isn't going to find him either, right? I mean, it is about having those sources. So I stress to anybody listening to this that's in law enforcement, if you don't have sources at every single level, start developing them, because people will talk. You have to talk to those people. But in every group, in every criminal organization, there are people that are willing to talk for multiple different motives, multiple different reasons. And I just don't think we can rely on these intel centers and all the technology as much as you can rely on building rapport with another human being. And like that's the person you're going to call when something goes bad.
Well said. Well said, Ski.
Yeah. Well, Fred, I appreciate you coming on and talking to us. It's been absolutely amazing. I'd love to have you back on. I know we're under a time crunch for you, and I'm going to respect that. And I know I'm going to have some questions sent to me. I've already had some of our listeners express that they enjoyed some of your books. So, I will forward some of those questions to you as well. And I look forward to any of your future projects coming out. And if you've got time in the future, I know you stay busy, I'll reach back out to you. We'd love to have you back on. We've really, really enjoyed it, man. I really, really appreciate it.
Well, the pleasure is mine. Thank you both for reaching out to me, and thank you for caring. And, you know, thank you for what you do. And please stay safe out there.
Yeah, yes, absolutely. Sir. And Fred, if you have another minute, we got a few more minutes on there. We always end, and we always talk about music. This is an ongoing theme. If Fred Burton is just relaxing, getting ready to write or whatever, what are you putting in on a CD player, record player, or streaming? What type of music?
Well, Ski, I'm old enough to admit that I saw Elvis Presley live.
Oh, wow.
And I also saw Bruce Springsteen before the Born to Run album came out. So,
oh, wow.
I was a very early Springsteen fan. So you'll find me probably listening to, in all probability, Thunder Road. Or you might find me listening to some old Birds music. So I'm a product of the 60s and the 70s.
That's all. The fact that you said you saw Elvis Presley in person, in the flesh, that is that's a way to end this right here. I love that. That's amazing.
It was a hell of a show. He still had it. He died about a year later. I saw him at the Capitol Center outside of Washington, D.C., and people are amazed when I mention that.
So you saw Fat Elvis.
Well, I think he had a few pounds. Let's look at that.
Yeah. Ski, what have you been listening to?
Oh, I have been hooked on, gosh, I keep going back, and I've probably already talked about this. Chris Cornell Songbook. It's an all acoustic album that he did in 2011. and I can't ever get rid of that. So sorry if I've repeated that, but go back to that.
Yeah. No, I've been stuck in, and maybe it's an era thing in the late 70s, but definitely early 80s. And I've just been mellowing out to Toto and a lot of Doobie Brothers. And I'm good with that. Like, it's been definitely about 3 or 4 days straight of Toto and Doobie Brothers.
Now, the Doobie Brothers thing, that doesn't have anything to do with your upcoming retirement, or is that just a...
It definitely has a lot to do with retirement, but okay. not in that sense, Ski, not in that sense. Just in mellowing out and relaxing.
I understand.
Well, I appreciate it, Fred. Thank you for your time. Ski, it's Disruptors out.
Thank you guys so much. Take care.
Yes, sir.